Adversaries are relentless, and they're only getting smarter, faster, and more sophisticated. Knowing their game is the only way to beat them. That's why we're here. Learn what it takes to protect against even the most sophisticated attacks. Welcome to the Adversary Universe podcast.
Good morning, Adam.
Good morning. Good morning. Is it a little? I think I might be a little. Is that better? Better levels? Levels?
No, that's a subtle distortion on that one.
Yeah, that was a little too much. Is it still there?
No, you sound good. You sound not as growly.
As growly. In a world surrounded by adversaries comes a man on a mission. Adam Myers is the CAO leader.
Welcome to another episode of the Adversary Universe podcast. I'm with the head of our counter-adversary operations group, Mr. Adam Myers. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm doing fantastic.
Got your energy drink ready to go?
I do have one. And I should probably slow down on these things because I've been experiencing some odd crashes around like 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And and then it takes me forever to get back into my stride, you know?
Maybe you need to upgrade your memory.
I do need to upgrade my memory.
Did you want to show off your new echo feature for the audience?
For the Adversary Universe podcast? You know, you're totally right. I think as we get deeper into these episodes and we start bringing on amazing guests, we've had some amazing speakers. I also think that we need to turn up the creativity just a notch. So whenever we mention the name of an adversary or even say the word adversary.
There it is.
You know, that's it right there. I'll just probably try to do an echo chamber. Maybe a more subtle one, right? Maybe something like
For anybody that questions if we have fun doing this podcast, I think
Of course we do. Like all right. So I have so many great ideas. We've been getting a lot of people reaching out saying, hey, I would love to be a guest on your show, and I would love to cover different topics. And we've had folks from the military and folks from different, you know, public sector agencies. And we've had folks in the commercial space reach out and say, I would love to be part of your show. I would love to talk about this. I'd love to talk about that. And then there's also been a tremendous amount of really great feedback on just the overall experience, and that the topics we cover are very digestible and we don't get overly technical. But at the same time, a lot of the content that you cover, Adam, has been like overwhelmingly well received, and they're just, you know, everyone just loves the content.
Oh, well, that's good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Literally every time I go anywhere now, I hear Morgan Adamski from NSA asking on stage if she had Cheerios in her hair when you called her the boogeyman.
Oh my God.
And I'm like, do I have Cheerios in my hair? Cause that's a thing apparently. Yeah. When you have like little kids, you never know.
I just pictured that scene from Monsters, Inc. actually, when the monsters were actually putting the, you know, those Cheerios on the floor to lead the baby towards the living room. They had a newspaper laid out. And anyway.
That's how NSA snares people.
Yeah. That's how they catch them. Exactly. I think one interesting and very consistent question that keeps coming up, especially for folks that are either newer to the concept of operationalizing intelligence or different analysts that are coming into this industry for the first time, you know, a little more on the junior side, they've been asking a question on like, what is the importance of this attribution? Like, why do we have these naming conventions? What does it mean to the way that they interpret the data or the articles that we publish or the reports that we publish? And I thought we would maybe spend a little time on this episode, taking a step back, right, from some of the very, you know, deep dive conversations that we've historically had on geopolitics and types of tradecraft that have been attributed to some of the more prolific campaigns that have made the news, like the Microsoft hack, for example. And let's talk about like why the attribution, which one? Ooh. Well, in any event, we're getting some cues from our producers to keep this show going. And by the way, shout out to the producers who help us put this podcast together. So
let's talk about the producers for a while.
Jeff Taylor, I'd like to give you a thank you and a shout out. And then Jen Langdon for, you know, the support on the technical side. And then Miss Sheridan, right? Mrs. Sheridan?
Mm-hmm. Kelly.
Kelly Sheridan. So thank you so much for all the hard work. So, Oscar
attribution.
Speech? Attribution. Yeah, attribution. There we go. Okay, so we're back to it. So,
aren't those energy drinks supposed to focus you?
You know what? I took three sips so far, and I think halfway through this podcast, I'll find my stride, and then we'll be wrapping up. So, So attribution, like, why is it so important? And maybe a little background that you can share, Adam, when you started building out this program here. I get excited whenever someone sends me an article from some third party news outlet that says, hey, here's some activity that's being tracked, tied to like Rocket Kitten or, you know, Gothic Panda. And they're using, or Scatter Spider, especially Scatter Spider over the past year alone. And they're using our nomenclature. And so I think that's pretty exciting to see that the industry has been referencing our naming convention for adversaries. But I also think it would help to maybe level set and have you maybe explain what that looks like, why we built it, how we built it, and then what that means to defenders and how they actually can leverage that you know, that intelligence attribution concept. And then why does even attribution matter in the grand scheme of all of the different campaigns that we're tracking and all the attacks that we're monitoring?
Yeah, this, you know, there's so much to unpack with this topic. And I think, you know, how to approach this would be to start off with why attribution matters. And that is something that I have been addressing with folks in the industry for, you know, the better part of even before CrowdStrike, but certainly since we started CrowdStrike. And a lot of folks, when we first launched the company, were saying, you know, this isn't your job. You guys should leave this to the government. And attribution doesn't matter to a commercial company because we just want to stop the bad guys. We don't care if they're China or Russia or criminals. And, you know, this persists today. I still see a lot of people piping in on Twitter. Usually it's people with like 20 followers that start throwing shade on attribution and why would you do attribution. And what we've said from the very beginning at CrowdStrike is that you don't have a malware problem, you have an adversary problem. And the way that you deal with an adversary is that you need to understand who they are, everything you can about them. This is what intelligence is all about, right? So, you know, there's a great quote, I think it was Robert Clark in his book, mentioned about intelligence, that it's really trying to, I'll paraphrase here, I don't remember the exact quote, but I've used it many times, which is, you know, intelligence is about understanding what the adversary doesn't want you to know about them. And that's at the core why you need to do attribution. You need to understand, if you're being targeted by an adversary, wouldn't it be good to know why? Right? Are they interested in deploying ransomware?
Yeah.
Are they trying to steal intellectual property? Do you have a board meeting occurring in a place where they would like to get more information? And so each attack, each attempt at an intrusion can reveal a lot about the intentions of an adversary, what they're after, who they're after, and timing. And if you start to pull those strands together, now you can understand a little bit more about who this adversary is and what they're after. And, you know, does it matter if it's unit 61318 or the GRU 77445? Like, it maybe not to most people, but I would argue it does matter. But what, you know, at the core, is this a nation state? Is this a criminal? Is this a hacktivist? Right? That simple question can inform your next responses. It can inform where you start to make investments in your security architecture. And then as you dial it in a little bit further, if it's a nation state, which nation state?
Yeah.
Is it China? Is it Russia? Is it Iran? Is it some other nation state? And as you start to look at which nation state, then you can start to say, well, why would they target us? You know, one example always comes to mind was talking to some automotive executives, and they were in the middle of an intrusion and they were targeted by Ocean Buffalo. You know who Ocean Buffalo is?
It's Vietnam, correct?
Vietnam, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a specific military unit within Vietnam. And they're a kind of dual hat where they have the military responsibility, but they're also responsible for state-owned enterprises. And some of the fastest growing and most important state-owned enterprises in Vietnam are?
I don't know.
So one of the most important state-owned enterprises in Vietnam are their automotive industry. They're racing to try to compete and build cars for their own domestic use, but also to then export and to grow their economy. And so why would Vietnam target an automotive company? Well, you could probably start to figure that out pretty quick. Right? Yeah. And now are you going to be competing with yet another automotive company who's now taken some of your intellectual property and able to leapfrog over what you're currently doing, or at least get parity with what you're doing? Mm. So attribution, I think, is really important if you want to defend your business, right? If you're only thinking about it in terms of defending a computer or a server, okay, maybe it doesn't matter that much.
Sure.
But if you start thinking about it at a strategic level, how am I going to defend my business from myriad of threat actors whose motivations are constantly changing, right? This is why threat intelligence is so important. And a lot of folks question why threat intelligence is important. What do they do? And they really focus on the, take it back to the 90s, right? Like, I have a firewall and I'm blocking these ports. And so, that's good enough, right? I've built security into my enterprise, and that's as far as I'm going to go. Well, that's not necessarily good enough.
Yeah.
And so you need to understand when somebody is targeting you, what they're after, who what are they trying to do? Because, from a very narrow focus of just protecting the physical equipment, maybe you don't care.
Yeah.
But I can guarantee that your business leaders, the executive leadership at the company or within your organization certainly care about the longevity of the organization and the business. They care about being able to be profitable. They care about competition. They care about winning contracts and winning work. And so all of these things can be targeted by an adversary.
Yeah.
So you want to know who these adversaries are so that you can take appropriate measures.
When did this really start becoming, I'll use the term mainstream, right? Because when I got into the industry in the early 2000s, the concept of attribution or even naming conventions, it was something I was very unfamiliar with. And quite frankly, when I did run across my first Intel report, the attribution identifier was typically met with an APT reference, right? I think there was a very specific Mandiant use of naming convention. And so what was the timing where it became a little more public?
I'll tell you, for me, when it first became public, or when it first became important, and when it really kind of galvanized my focus on this, was in, I want to say it was 1998.
Okay.
And I remember sitting in my dorm room and on my Linux computer, reading Hacker News Network, and they were talking about this suspected intrusion that was tied to Russia, which became Moonlight Maze.
Okay.
And that captivated me. Because I remember thinking, wow, nation states doing hacking. That's really interesting. And I was kind of an aspiring hacker at that time. I wanted to nothing more than to be a red teaming pen tester.
Yeah.
And that's actually where I started my career. But, that was really, for me, kind of eye-opening. And then in the summer of 2000, I was in college still, and I had switched to political science because I was not a very good student. But in the summer of 2000, there was an international incident. A Chinese fighter jet bumped a P-3 Orion over the, the South China Sea. And the P-3 Orion landed on Hainan Island. And the Chinese captured it. The crew didn't do what they were supposed to do and destroy the cryptographic equipment and everything. That they didn't have, I guess, time or whatever it was. And I remember watching the news and seeing this stripped down P-3 Orion sitting on a runway in Hainan Island as the Chinese were reverse engineering everything on board, the microchips off and just going through this thing with a fine tooth comb. And it became, over the course of that summer, I think it was 2000, a pretty big incident. And what erupted was a hacker war. There were U.S. hackers that were hacking Chinese infrastructure, Chinese hackers hacking U.S. infrastructure, and this went back and forth and back and forth. And I ended up, I was taking a political science class at the time called Coercive Diplomacy, which talks about how can you use coercion as a diplomatic tool to force a country to take some action by threat of coercion. And I wrote my final paper for that on information warfare as a mechanism to implement coercive diplomacy. And I remember the teacher gave me back the grade, and it was one of the few A's I ever received in college.
Nice.
Other than my Unix system administration class that I took to complete my computer science degree. But the I got this A, and he wrote in the margin, I had no idea that this was possible. This is fascinating.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And
you changed his life.
Well, I don't know about that.
Oh, but, I'm going to go on a limb and say you changed his life.
I should look up that professor to see if he's even still out there. But that really kind of started cementing in my mind that we need to know who these threat actors are and to be able to, like, this is going to be a thing. This is going to be a problem.
Yeah.
And when we launched CrowdStrike, the early kind of mandate that I got, right? And I was one of the first, you know, 8 employees at CrowdStrike. I won't go into the specifics of the numbers, but I was one of the earliest employees, helped launch the company. And George, the CEO, said to me, I want government quality intelligence for the private sector. Mm. Right? We knew early on that the intel would drive how we build our defenses, how we instrument our tooling, how we look for the adversary. And that model, that approach is why we are able to grow and chase the adversary through the cloud, why we're able to chase the adversary and apply identity protection to start to go after things like Scattered Spider and watch how their techniques evolve. Because, you know, if you take any given company in the world, I can go talk to them and say, hey, this is your vertical, this is your geo, this is what we know about you. And here's the adversaries you need to worry about, right? You could worry about every adversary and take it from a purely technical approach of best practices of security tools based on what vendors are telling you or whatever. Or you could take a look at the actual data of the threats, what they're up to, and make informed decisions so that you can spend your security budget more wisely, so that you can leverage the SOX time more effectively, so that you can have better business outcomes and start to bring strategy to the defense of your business.
Yeah. No, that's actually pretty powerful, because I think when I started with CrowdStrike almost 10 years ago, I think I've said this before in other episodes, I fell in love with the intelligence arm of the company. And even during the interview process, under NDA, I got access to an intel report that your team produced. And I just lost my mind, right? I was like, oh my God, like, I need to work for this company, right? And so I was so stoked to get on board. But what was an interesting challenge back then, I would say it's almost the inverse now. But back then, when I would go and meet with these enterprises across the country, and I would talk about the way that we were creating these intelligence reports and the way we were tracking adversary campaigns, a lot of the feedback I got then was, well, hey, we're in this industry, and we don't really think that we're being targeted by a nation state, or like, why would I need to know about this group targeting me? And there was this, I don't want to say they were naive, but there was this interesting sentiment on, well, I already have these very traditional, call them antiquated defenses in place. Why do I need to know if this e-crime group is targeting me, or I'm part of some nation state attack, or it was really more of an assumption of, like, why would China want to target me? I think we're okay. We don't need that. And now I can tell you, I've had many meetings with a lot of those, I don't want to call them naysayers, but those original enterprises that weren't necessarily understanding the value of intelligence then. They are all over it now, and they've built programs that operationalize the ingestion of intelligence, and they want to understand, even if they're not part of an industry that a group is targeting, they would like to understand how they can indirectly be impacted by that. And so it's an interesting change in perspective of, I think we've just seen so much of this attribution make it into the eyes of the media and different news outlets that do put a spotlight on the likes of Scattered Spider and their tradecraft and who they've been targeting. And the awareness level now is just, I think, phenomenal, right? Where there's a lot more companies that are taking intelligence serious. But I'm very curious though, because there's so many activity clusters that we're tracking. There's so many groups that we've we've even added, I think, based upon the most recent global threat report, there's what, 34 new adversaries.
We've added like 5 or 6 already this year, if not more.
Yeah, so that blows my mind. And I think that, you know, if I'm on the enterprise side, if I'm on the customer side and I'm receiving this intelligence, I'd be very curious on like, how do we start to differentiate between these adversaries, right? And then maybe you can also explain the concept of how these groups start to splinter off from each other to set up kind of their own campaigns and, you know, their own initiatives. Are they playing dominoes one day sitting on the porch and they just get into an argument because somebody wins? Or, you know, is it just more of egos? Or, you know, just maybe even go back to the episode that we did with behavioral analysis, right? So, and profiling. Yeah. So,
well, look, I think, you know, you have to recognize that, as I said, there's 3 motivations. And when I first started at CrowdStrike and we first started talking about adversaries and we would start encountering people that were saying, oh, you shouldn't be doing this. Mm-hmm. This isn't your job, blah, yeah. blah, 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 blah. You know, I said, look, let's start with just motivation. Let's take away like me doing attribution and calling out a specific person or a specific, you know, military unit or intelligence agency. Let's just start with motivation. You have espionage, which is sabotage, disruptive, destructive, or I should say nation state, which is espionage, sabotage, disruptive, destructive attacks. And later North Korea also started using their same capabilities for financial gain, revenue generation for the regime. You have e-crime. And at the time we started the company, this was a lot of botnets just stealing, you know, credit card information and doing like wire fraud and things like that. In fact, we didn't even really care about e-crime until a couple of years in as it started to evolve. Because when we first started the company, it was kind of a nuisance and it was a lot of botnets. Mm. And then hacktivism. And CrowdStrike formed, you know, right at the after the wrap-up of the Occupy Wall Street movement, which had quite a bit of anonymous activity.
I remember that, yeah.
And inside of that was this subset of activity, which tracked to LulzSec, which was kind of a growth or an expansion of the anti-sec movement, which has been around since the 90s. And so, you know, those 3 motivations were the things that we were talking to a lot of companies about. And a lot of, you know, people that were anti-attribution would be like, all right, fine. Like, I guess that kind of makes sense. You know, in terms of how these groups splinter, how they change over time, you have to remember, you know, in the case of China, you're talking about the People's Liberation Army or the Ministry of State Security or, you know, other organizations. And, you know, I remember in 2015, September, President Obama and President Xi sat down and they signed this bilateral agreement that there would be no hacking for economic espionage. And looking at that and saying the Chinese know that they're not going to honor this, but they also know that they're going to be restructuring the entire PLA. The PLA up until 2016 had 7 military regions. And those military regions were reorganized into a more of a combatant command structure where they had, rather than 7, you know, different districts, they had north, south, east, west, central. And those that caused a reorganization of the technical reconnaissance spaces that were being used as part of these cyber operations. It had you know, all kinds of impact at the management and structure of the actual units. And so over the course of the next year, the PLA groups really disappeared, especially in the way that we were tracking them, because we were tracking everything to the 3rd General Staff Department, which had 12 different subordinate bureaus. And we were, you know, had tied all that stuff together. And then when they reorganized, those TRBs became part of the theater commands. And so much changed inside of the structure that those groups effectively reconstituted after a year or two. In some cases, we're still seeing, you know, new reconstitution of previous actors and activities. And so the way that these things change can be because of things of administrative changes, like I just mentioned. Mm-hmm. It could be because some group is falling in or out of favor. as president. She started rising to power. He had done some changes within the Ministry of State Security. And, you know, there was famously a bunch of folks who went to jail from within that organization because of misuse of funds and grift and things like that. Yeah. And so, you know, as that changed, it changed which groups were given which missions. And then, you know, as indictments occur and these things become exposed, when we put out reports that become public that expose things like back in 2015, maybe it was Putter Panda. I think it was 2015. Was Putter Panda Unit 61486, which was the 12th Bureau of the 3rd General Staff Department. And we actually had gotten attribution down to the headquarters building because somebody had made a mistake with a domain registration.
Oh, wow.
And so when that happens, you know, they might move the mission to another team or another group. So all of these changes have occurred. And then geopolitical changes occur. Look at what happened with Russia and Ukraine, right? Russia had been very focused on the West and Europe and NATO. And then as the conflict in Ukraine really started to escalate in the last couple of years, they reprioritized what they were going after. And now you start to see more and more of the Russian focus is on the conflict that they're currently fighting in Ukraine. Iran, you know, another geopolitical change there. You know, a lot of folks might remember when Iran targeted the Albanian government probably about a year and a half ago. And that was because of a group called MEK, which is a dissident group that was effectively operating outside of inside of Albania against Iran. And Iran was really annoyed by this. So they took some action. So we're constantly seeing these changes because of internal structures, because of prioritization. Mm-hmm. Think about stuff like within China, they have the Belt and Road Initiative.
Yep.
They have the 5-year plan. They have the Made in China 2025 initiative. They have all of these running long-term initiatives where they need to go out and achieve certain objectives that they've set for themselves. So that drives their collection and their direction. Another good example is North Korea. North Korea was cut off from SWIFT. And when they got cut off from SWIFT, we start seeing a massive targeting of the fintech and the blockchain and, you know, cryptocurrency companies.
Yeah, cryptocurrency is going through. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. So like these changes, you know, I guess to say in summary that there's so many factors that go into these changes and so many different variables that we need to track. And that's why we do threat intelligence the way we do. And then how do we action that? We apply it to threat hunting. The Overwatch team is one of the things that kind of sets CrowdStrike apart, and their ability to go find things and how quickly they can find things is unprecedented. And the amount of data that they're looking at, the amount of information that they're able to process and how quickly they can zero in on something. Brody Nisbet, the guy that runs threat hunting, had a post on Twitter the other day that I liked, and it was like a meme from Jurassic Park, and it was kind of adversary. I forget what it was exactly, but it was like after 6 years, adversary makes one OPSEC failure, and then it was like the next panel was Overwatch, and it was the dinosaur next to the guy in Jurassic Park just looking. But I mean, they're kind of, I always think of them as kind of having like that anonymous tagline of we do not forgive, we do not forget, expect us.
That's funny.
That's kind of the Overwatch perspective. And they're bringing that visibility into our identity products, into our cloud products. So now we're able to cross domain threat hunt, which is, you know, absolutely just exciting to see how quickly we can find new, interesting stuff.
Yeah.
No, and this matters, you know, sorry.
Go for
I'm
it.
I'm going to rant.
No, man. Go for it.
You got me going, man. I don't even have an energy drink. You know, while we're talking about all this, think about what's just happened recently with the XZ open source package that ended up getting a backdoor. And if you take a look at what happened, you look at the Git repo for that package, and you start looking at how this unfolded, an adversary like 2 years ago started to use human intelligence, you know, collection techniques to start to build a legend for themselves within the open source community, contributing to projects and going through this like very kind of robotic process to add content to some projects and add some value. And ultimately, after 2 years, their goal was to get this backdoored library into mainstream Linux distributions. Yeah. And they were unsuccessful.
Yeah, that's a you know, I read about this one and I thought it was interesting for a few reasons. One, we still need to publish a supply chain attack episode. But it's also what also caught my attention was the implications that this could have had across, you know, to your point, those Linux distributions that could have been compromised, right? We're talking, I mean, like massive, right, impact across
it. It was, yeah, it was basically a skeleton key,
yeah,
that would have been in every SSH daemon.
Yeah.
Right. Not to be overly dramatic, but like that's effectively what the goal was.
Sure. Yeah.
And if they had accomplished that, that would have been pretty significant.
Yeah. Across on-premise and even cloud systems, right? I mean, we're like, yeah, it's massive. So
even IoT, I mean, like,
and IoT, good point.
Far enough, like, it would have been everywhere.
Yeah, it would have been everywhere. No, I read this one. It's a really good write-up on it, and it kind of blew my mind, like the potential impact that could have had. You know, so you mentioned something that I do want to go back to, and it was this concept of the adversary making a mistake, right? And that ultimately leading, you mentioned it also with Brody's Twitter post, right? Or X post? What is it? Anyway, we'll figure it out. The post that used to tweet. You know, the adversary makes a mistake, and that ultimately can lend itself to us confirming attribution. So I'm very curious if you can share a little bit of that process of your team is continuously monitoring these campaigns. Your team is involved in keeping a very close eye on where they're originating from. And there's something that has to drop in order for us to be 100% certain that it's this group at this given moment, right? For that attribution to ultimately occur and make its way into a finished report. Otherwise, well, you know, like what does that look like? You know,
I think you just hit on something that's really important. You said 100% certain.
Yep.
And that's what breaks most people.
Okay. Right? Yeah.
Where I lose most people in the discussion is when they are binary in terms of, you know, it's either yes or no, on or off, 100% or 0%.
Got it.
And the thing about intelligence is that there's very, very rarely will we have 100% certainty. And so when we, you know, if anybody reads our blog posts that come from the Intel team, or you're a customer and you're consuming our threat intelligence reporting, then you will see that we use a number of things that we've borrowed from the intelligence community in terms of estimative language, where we will provide both a likelihood and a confidence. So, you know, and when we talk about likelihood you know, it's likely that, like, we use different words to kind of avoid giving numeric equivalents.
I see.
So rather than, you know, 50%, we'll say, you know, even chances.
Okay.
But we'll use that estimative language to make the products read a little bit better. And then when we talk about confidence, I might, you know, somebody might say, equal chances that China's behind this attack with high confidence.
Okay, got it.
Confidence has to do with the number and veracity and a whole set of source evaluations, because we have lots of different sources that we can leverage to make our analytic judgments. We can have technical verification, right? Mm-hmm. Which might give us a higher degree of confidence. We could have, you know, others have confirmed this, right? Other people have confirmed this. It could be because we've been interacting or monitoring with a threat actor or something like that, that we're able to start to see, you know, maybe we have multiple sources that are confirming something, right? Mm-hmm. There could be a technical one. There could be somebody talking about it on a forum or something, or whatever it might be. So there's lots of different ways for us to kind of establish that confidence. And by conveying likelihood and confidence, that kind of allows us to make these judgments that we might have and to let the customer or the reader understand that we don't have all the answers. This is not black or white. This is based on what we're seeing. And I just savaged Microsoft for this the other day because in the wake of the China intrusion that they suffered last summer, they had 46 hypotheses that they were running down. And it was everything from, somebody left the key on a USB stick on the metro or something like that, all the way up to the threat actor had quantum computers and broke cryptography.
Oh, wow.
And so some of those, we would probably pare those down pretty significantly based off of like actual, technology and likelihood of those things occurring. But there's a tool that the analysts use called alternative competing hypothesis, where, if you don't know the answer to something or you there's possibilities, you can start to build a chart or a graph or a spreadsheet or whatever it might be. And you could start to put different aspects of each hypothesis together and use that to start to ascertain or figure out what the most likely candidate is.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And if there's some, maybe there's two or three, we'll present all two or three if it helps our customer understand what we're saying a little bit better, right? So there's a whole set of analytic tools that go into the intelligence discipline that I think a lot of folks don't understand when they start, rage posting on Twitter about attribution because, I'll never have 100% certainty in anything unless I meet the threat actor and start talking to them.
Yeah. It, oh, wow. Right? That's a very valuable point. Yeah.
Yeah. So I there is a lot of work that you need to do in order to say like, hey, like we don't know for certain, but we think this, and here's the evidence that proves it or that supports that, I should say. And here's other evidence that doesn't support that. And, ultimately the goal of intelligence is to empower the decision makers to make the right decision. And if we could do that quickly, and if we can do that in a way that at least gives them all of the pieces so that they can kind of see like where their blind spots are with when they make that decision, then, hopefully they're making a good decision. And where this gets a little bit different in the threat intelligence space, right, in the cyber domain, is that we have, in addition to all that intelligence, we have things that we can kind of provide in terms of giving a customer information that they could use to drive their hunting operations, or they can use to drive their detection engineering, or they can use to drive their SOC management, right? Prioritization. So there's a lot of things that come out of threat intelligence that, tie back to attribution, but they have very meaningful and real actions that the team can take to operationalize that intelligence. And that's kind of the key thing that, we're trying to do is to help take the intelligence, take all the things that we're seeing and understanding, and giving our customers strategic options, right? Strategic information that they can use to drive defenses for their business. It could be tied to purchases of security tools or equipment. It could be architectural decisions, all kinds of things that inform that more strategic level decision making. And then tactical. Tactical might be, here's some indicators to go look for. Here's some things that you should do. There's a new vulnerability. Here's what the conditions are for being properly exploited. And here's what we know about the exploitation about it. Is it in the wild? Is it not in the wild? All of those tactical level decisions can really help the short-term kind of security and make, make the difference between somebody having to work the whole weekend or being able to leave on Friday and say, oh, I just read this report about this thing. Not a concern for us right now.
Yeah.
Or maybe it is a concern and we're going to go full war room. Yeah. And then we have, beyond the tactical, we have lots of other types of intelligence products. I lost count of how many different products we have, but One of the big marks of success for us with, you know, from an Intel perspective, and I realize we're moving away from attribution a little bit, but, sure. You know, we have a daily report that goes to our customers. And one of the things that that allows them to do is to get kind of that broad perspective of everything that's happened over the last 24 hours. So when their management team or their leadership team or their boss comes to them and says, what do we know about this? They have some information, right? They have something that they're like, oh, well, this happened, blah, 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 blah. And we know X, Y, and Z, and we've already taken these actions, right? That's ultimately what that's about.
I have a question about that because I've had a few conversations with different customers in different industries, and they say, hey, we have a great SOC. We love your intel. It supercharges our operations center, our security operations center, but we really are just interested in anything that is applicable to, you know, fintech, right? For example, or the health industry. Do you think? And I don't want to say argue it, but I always say like, well, you should also maybe know what's happening with maybe even neighboring industries, right? Because why not understand how this tradecraft impacts a potential partner of yours, or even understanding that tradecraft that may be targeted towards one industry now, could it potentially be something that's used against your industry, right? And it makes its way into a different vertical. And so like, what's your take on that? Like, do you think organizations should put on the horse blinders and just operationalize the intel only for the vertical, or should they be aware of, you know, neighboring industries? I mean, what is that? What's your recommendation?
What a great question. That could probably be its own podcast, to be honest. Yeah. But, you know, I think the, as you look at we do vertical reports.
Yeah.
And in our vertical reports, we always kind of show adjacent and related industries. Right. So you might be in healthcare, but you're dependent on these other things. You have ties to these other verticals, right? Insurance and, you know, medical technology and pharmacology. You know, there's so many different things that are part of that ecosystem, professional consulting services or telecommunications, right? There's so many things that these industries have as dependencies and interconnections too, that we call that out in those vertical reports, because you're right, you can't be super myopic and only look through the lens of the vertical that you're in. And it's not just vertical, it's also geo.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
so if you're pick an industry,
automotive,
fintech.
Yeah, or fintech.
Would you say?
Yeah, I say automotive, but go fintech.
Automotive.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you're automotive and you're doing business in just the US, you know, maybe your risk factors are different than if you also have operations in South Korea, right? Because while you might not necessarily consider North Korea a foe as a US automotive, but if you have operations in South Korea, then geopolitical tensions could spill over and impact you in ways that you need to understand. Understanding adjacencies in terms of verticals, understanding dependencies, because this gets to supply chain issues, and understanding what technology you're dependent on. NotPetya back in 2017 is a good example. NotPetya was a fake ransomware variant that was going around. And NotPetya was originally targeted at Ukraine. And we've attributed this to Voodoo Bear, which is associated with the GRU. And this was part of their campaign targeting Ukraine. NotPetya was able to self-propagate. And what it would do is it would dump creds and then take those creds and try to use them to move laterally to other systems. And the impact or the blast area of NotPetya quickly expanded beyond Ukraine, because there were a lot of organizations that were subcontracting dev work to orgs in Ukraine, or they had operations in Ukraine because they're multinational, you know, global companies. And if you're doing business in Ukraine, one of the software that was very popular was an accounting package called MEDoc. And that was backdoored by the Voodoo Bear actors, and they used that update mechanism to ultimately push down NotPetya as the initial infection vector. And so, you know, all this to say that a healthcare company or a shipping company or whatever it was in the United States that didn't necessarily see itself as tied to the Ukraine-Russia conflict way back in 2017, maybe they didn't even know that it was happening, found themselves the victim of a fake ransomware that actually had no recovery mechanism. In fact, I don't know if you remember this, but the NotPetya actually, there was no mechanism to recover it because it discarded the key after the encryption. So it was basically a wiper that used encryption to do the wiping. And that had a significant impact. So, you know, to your question about knowing if it, you know, if it's only one vertical or only one geo, you need to understand that these things have ways of spilling over from conflict areas or issues that could impact you.
Yeah. No, that's actually really, really great insight. And that's also a really fantastic example. I do remember NotPetya just being just destructive in nature, right? That was pretty much it, right? So, you know, I think we can probably talk about a variety and plethora of attacks that drive the reason why we do attribution. But do you have any parting words again for maybe, again, some of the folks that are newer to the concept of operationalizing intelligence and why attribution is so important? Maybe some advice on, you know, where they should start and what type of direction they should start maturing their program in.
Yeah, we actually have something you could go get for free, which would be to go to adversary.crowdstrike.com, and you could put your geographic location and your business vertical or verticals or geolocations, I should say, and it will build a custom threat map, which will show all of the threat actors that we've observed that are targeting your vertical and your geo. And if you look at those threat actors and you figure out which ones are the ones that you're most concerned about, then you can start looking at their TTPs, their tactics, techniques, and procedures. And if you understand their TTPs, then you understand how they typically get in, how they typically operate, how they move laterally, and what they're after. And as you start to understand that, now you can align that to your defensive posture. One of the tools a lot of folks like to use is the MITRE ATT&CK framework. So you could take a look at our adversaries and our reporting and where the MITRE ATT&CK framework overlays with that from an attacker perspective. And then if you have a MITRE ATT&CK framework for your defensive posture, you can find the gaps. Yeah. And that would be the simplest way to very quickly use intelligence to help make informed decisions about where you might have some gaps in your defenses.
Oh, that's awesome. That's really great. So
another way to do that too is to now take that proactively and say, okay, we're in a vertical that's heavily targeted by this group. Let's say it's Cascade Panda. Well, if you understand Cascade Panda's tools, tactics, and procedures, now you can start to use your red team to model those procedures and tactics and say, okay, pretend you're Cascade Panda. Let's do a red team exercise and see if we can find it.
I like that. Like an adversary emulation engagement. And that was adversary. What was the website? Because I think you can also go to
adversary.crowdstrike.com.
Adversary.crowdstrike.com. Or you can also go to crowdstrike.com/adversaries. Too much?
No, more.
Okay. Adam, very insightful, fantastic overview of how we do attribution, why it's so important. Again, this has been a topic that comes up, I would say, in almost every public engagement that we do or public speaking events. And we hope that we get some more feedback and we want your questions. And so feel free to reach out to us. The producers will put that same website that Adam just referenced in our show notes. So thank you so much, Adam. This is really fun once again. And
always a pleasure.
Yeah, always a pleasure. And for those of you who are listening, thank you so much for the support. This is the Adversary Universe podcast, and we're out. See you at the next one.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode. If you like what you're hearing, subscribe to our podcast and head over to crowdstrike.com/adversaries to learn more about the many bad guys we track. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on the Adversary Universe podcast.
This is the Adversary Universe podcast,